Well, thanks for the invitation to talk. I don't know if I'm as prestigious as it was indicated in the beginning, but you have to take that as a little bit of hyperbole. So what I'd like to talk to you about this afternoon is some of the experimental work that my lab's been doing on coevolution between the sexes. And for the last 10 years, we've focused on antagonistic coevolution between the sexes. And one of the major themes I'm going to take today is to evaluate one of the criticisms of the last 25 years of work, especially in the melanogaster, the common fruit fly model system. And that's that much of the harm that we've measured might actually be compensated, might be compensated by females being harmed by males, but in return getting superior genes for their offspring. And if these superior genes more than compensate for the costs, all we've been calling conflict for the last 25 years is really mutual benefit. So I want to start by the bigger question. Why would we expect there to be sexual conflict in the first place? We can get an idea for why this might be true by plotting the fitness of a male and the fitness of a female where the two individuals come together in the context of reproduction. If we have strict lifelong monogamy, no cheating, and we used molecular markers in the last 15 years to find out a lot of monogamous things like birds, they cheat like crazy. This is when they don't cheat. There's a perfect correlation between the fitness of the two interacting members, and there can't be any conflict. Conflict cannot occur in monogamy if it's strict monogamy. But if we have any deviation from monogamy, some promiscuity in one or both sexes, then the genetic correlation between an interacting pair in their lifetime fitness is reduced, and this opens up a window of opportunity for sexual conflict. We can now have adaptations that favor one member of the interacting pair at the expense of the other. So, in general, coevolution occurs between the sexes. Yes? Pardon? Suppose there's...
If I go up, so the male fitness increases, right?
That's right.
If I go down, the male fitness
declines.
The female fitness starts to become quite good, the female fitness increases and the male decreases. Or you would just say that they go up?
A positive correlation. So if males and females do something, suppose they decide not to feed their young, well then the fitness of the male goes down, and so does the fitness of the female. Now suppose the female decides not to...
Yes?
No, it's a correlation, it's not a slope. Pardon? Well, if... If a trait evolves in males, for example, that he stops helping as much, he helps half as much, then his fitness, if there's a one-to-one correspondence between the resources he invests in offspring and how many he produces, his fitness goes down by half, and so does the fitness of his mate. So if the male cheats by not helping his mate as much, it hurts both of them to the same degree.
But then it could be the same line as monogamy.
No, the male fitness can go up, but female fitness doesn't go up to the same degree. Why don't we come back to this at the end? So coevolution occurs when males adapt in response to the characteristics of females, and females adapt in response to the characteristics of the males. It is antagonistic coevolution when males have an adaptation, the evolution of a trait in males, that increases their fitness at the expense of their mates. What might such a trait be? In the flies that I study, seminal fluid does things that are good for the males. When a male mates with a female, you know that he gives her sperm. But that sperm is packaged in a fluid called seminal fluid, and it contains about 80 different proteins. Many of these proteins make their way into the bloodstream of the female, and they do things that are good for the male. They migrate to the brain, and they reduce the sexual appetite of the female, which in this promiscuous species is good for the male, but not necessarily good for the female, because she can't mate with superior males when she finds them. It also increases her ovulation rate. Because these flies are promiscuous, females tend to remate the next day or the day after, or sometime soon thereafter. And when she does, most of the resident male sperm are removed, and they're replaced with sperm from the second male. So males are trying to maximize the short-term fecundity of females, and females are trying to maximize their lifetime fecundity. There are plenty of opportunities for conflict between the sexes to occur, where males can do something that's good for them, but bad for the female. Seminal fluid, by the way, is mildly toxic to females in flies. The more they receive, the more short their life is. Females will then evolve to counter this harm. They'll counter-adapt so that they aren't hurt as much. And if these counter-adaptations reduce the efficiency of males in sexual selection, that selects them to counter-counter-adapt, and we can initiate a cycle, a positive feedback cycle of adaptation and counter-adaptation that can go on for a protracted period of time. So where's the controversy? The controversy is in this part, the idea that males are evolving traits that are harmful to their mates. Most of the evidence comes from the Drosophila melanogaster laboratory model system, but there have been many natural history studies that support this idea as well. We have very good evidence that there are traits in males, like seminal fluid proteins, that do things that are good for the male at the expense of his mates. The fly in the ointment, though, so to speak, is that females may actually benefit by this harm. If females, by interacting with males, have their lifetime fecundity reduced, but they, by interacting with males, they can mate with different males and trade up to higher quality genes for their offspring in the context of viability, called the good genes hypothesis, or in the context of just making sexy sons, then the quality of the offspring goes up. So even though fewer offspring are produced, if their quality goes up, they make more grandchildren for the parents, so when measured across two generations, they actually gain. All the measurements of harm to females have been done across one generation. If females recoup this cost by getting higher quality genes for their offspring, what looks like harm may not be harm at all. So if these indirect genetic benefits, they're indirect because they take an extra generation to transpire. Their progeny aren't more numerous, but their grandchildren are. If the indirect benefits counter the direct costs, then what we've interpreted as antagonistic coevolution may in fact be mutualistic coevolution, which occurs via traditional models of sexual selection that have been known since the 1920s. So I'm going to tell you about a series of experiments that we've done to address this issue with the Drosophila melanogaster, common fruit fly, model system. And I want to tell you a little bit about what we do and don't do in the lab. First, we don't use the inbred lines that most cell and molecular biologists use and many other evolutionary biologists use. This is because these flies have been bottlenecked down to small size many times. Every time this happens, harmful mutations can accumulate by random effects, by random genetic drift, despite natural selection. So if I find a trait in males that is harmful to females, I don't know that it evolved because of selection in males for that trait. It might be a fortuitous byproduct of inbreeding depression in these lines. And if you look at the vigor of these lines compared to wild-type flies from nature, they're pretty pathetic. But we also don't look at recent flies that have been brought into the laboratory. If we measure interactions between the sexes of flies recently brought into the laboratory, they're in a foreign environment. Interactions, traits that males have when they interact with females that would be helpful to females in nature might be harmful under the foreign environment of the laboratory. So we can't study them when they're old and inbred or when they're new and not inbred. So what do? We use a technique we call laboratory island analysis. I'm going to walk you through the logic of this, then I'm going to show you how we actually do it. The logic is that most evolutionary geneticists go out to nature and they take a sample of animals or plants and they bring them into the laboratory and they use a toolkit for measuring genetic diversity that becomes more efficient, more sophisticated, seemingly by the minute, and we can do a remarkably good job at measuring standing genetic variation of populations by measuring that variation in the laboratory. But even if we measured the fitness among individuals in the laboratory, because it's a foreign environment, we can't extrapolate to what that means in nature. So we can do a good job of measuring genetic variation, but not the adaptive significance of that variation. In biology, for a long time, we've used island populations to understand the process of evolution. And the reason for this is that they're simpler. Biotically, they're simpler. On islands, there are fewer species interacting. And abiotically, the physical environment is less diverse because there are fewer habitats on an island compared to a continent. So what we've done in my laboratory is we've gone to nature, taken a large sample of flies, and adapted them for hundreds of generations, 350 when I made this slide, it's about 400 generations now, to a fairly competitive laboratory environment. And as a consequence, these flies, to a first approximation, now have the laboratory as their native environment. Well, how long is 350 generations? It's the amount of time that separates close ethnic groups in humans, like these Navajos and individuals from northern Siberia. It's far more time than it took to take the huge diversity of dogs we see among the European varieties. And it's even far longer to create all the diversity we see among Aquarius strains of guppies. Over 350 generations, we can move most quantitative traits large numbers of standard deviations. So in this period of time, we expect flies to adapt substantially to the laboratory environment. So once we take a population and adapt it to the lab for a long time, we can use the same genetic toolkit that everybody else uses, but now we can measure fitness in the laboratory, which is now their native environment, and we can make inference about the variation and its adaptive significance. So I need to tell you a little bit about how we propagate the flies, because the extent to which we mimic these conditions in our experiments will have a large effect on how reasonable it is to interpret in a meaningful way our experiments. So our base population, which we call LHM from the person who collected it, started in nature. It was an orchard in Modesto, and a colleague of mine, Larry Harshman, collected 400 mated females, reared the family from each female separately, checked the genitalia of the males to make sure it wasn't really a simulans, but not a melanogaster, and then just kept those that were truly melanogaster, not a different species. These flies are so similar in structure, you've got to look at the genitalia of males to tell one species from another. And then he was kind enough to give me a copy of the population, which I've maintained at large size ever since. Every generation, we start with about 10,000 eggs, individually metered out into vials, 56 vials total, with 150 to 200 eggs per vial. This density is far lower than most molecular and cellular biologists use to maintain their stocks, probably an order of magnitude lower. And that's because we're trying to give the flies an environment that's at least moderately similar to nature. The food is not the same as nature. It's a cornmeal molasses food, but the densities are more similar. Over the next few days, 9 days total, the eggs hatch, the larvae develop and compete. They spin a cocoon called a larval pupae, and then they hatch from these pupae starting on day 9. At this density, we have enough competition among the larvae to cause about 10% mortality. So there's a fair amount of rigor among the flies in competing for food. And then over the next 3 days, the emerging flies from their cocoons are going to become sexually mature, and most females have mated at least one time by the time they exit the juvenile competition stage of their life cycle. On day 12, out of a 14-day cycle, we radically reduce density from about 150 to 200 per vial down to just 16 pairs. We put the vials on their side to give the flies more space to spread out and have what we think are more meaningful behavioral interactions. Standard laboratory culture, there are hundreds of flies in a vial. They're literally elbow to elbow, and they can't have meaningful behavioral interactions like that. This way they can spread out, and they can go through their courtship ritual, and they can display most of the things that I see happening in my fly feeders that I have in my yard. So I spend a lot of time watching flies in my yard, which is nature for these human commensals, and the densities I have here are not noticeably different than what I see in my fly feeders. We also apply a small amount of live yeast to the killed yeast medium. This live yeast is critical for female reproduction. That's shown by this plot of mean female fecundity versus the amount of yeast that we provide. The amount we provide is down here, so there's intense scramble competition among the females for this limiting resource to reproduction, live yeast. And then there's competition among the males to inseminate the females and fertilize their eggs. 14 days before the end of their life cycle, we transfer the flies to fresh medium without yeast. Only the eggs that are laid during this brief interval, 18 hours out of a 14-day cycle, are used to start the next generation. We've selected the flies to be big bang reproducers, like salmon. Only the offspring produced at the end of their life contribute to the next generation. And this isn't done by accident. We designed this microcosm to make it easy to measure the lifetime fitness of the flies. Because we've restricted reproduction to a short period of time, it's far easier to measure. So we've created a population that makes it easy for us to measure the lifetime fitness of the individuals in the population. Pardon? Now, we start up here with 150 to 200 eggs, and then on day 12, we mix the flies among vials and then randomly select 16 pairs to go into each vial. And that's done so the flies can spread out and have more meaningful behavioral interactions.
So basically, you count about 90% of the population?
Correct. Randomly.
Randomly, yeah, but this is quite unnatural.
Oh, no, it's not at all. Flies are culled by nature probably more drastically than we cull in the laboratory. Lots of things like to eat flies.
Randomly?
Pardon? Oh, no, not randomly. There's natural selection going on. The natural selection we have goes on amongst those that we now select and allow to interact. But because we have about 2,000 individuals interacting, 16 pairs in a vial, but 56 vials, that's about 1,800 individuals, there's plenty of opportunity for natural selection to act. And there aren't small numbers that overpower that natural selection due to sampling error. Is what?
Is it for rapid breeding? Because you said that the first one was to be laid on the number of eggs. What is the selection for ordinary breeding?
Well, the selection's for lots of things. We aren't controlling the selection is for adaptation to this microcosm environment. So they're selected to do well in larval competition.
Yeah, but also, I thought that you were selecting for fast breeders because you say if you just lay, and you just lay eggs after 18 hours, and basically.
Well, there's very high variability in how many eggs females lay. How many eggs a female lays depends on how effective she was at competing with other females for the limiting resource, which is live yeast. There is substantial standing variation among females, genetic variation, for their fecundity in this microcosm. So there's not only environmentally induced variation, but there's substantial genetic variation. So there's plenty of opportunity for selection here. Some females lay a lot of eggs because they competed well for the limiting resource live yeast, and some relatively few. And then the males have to compete to mate with those females. Some males get no matings at all. Some get many matings. Some, when they get matings, are poor at sperm competition. So they mate with females, but when another male mates, he displaces most of the stored sperm from the previous male. There's manifest opportunity for selection in this microcosm. And it isn't affected in any way by our culling the flies down randomly from about 10,000 to about 2,000. Because it's done randomly, it's neutral to natural selection. So the first thing that we wanted to evaluate is a criticism of the microcosm that in nature, males patrol high-quality resources like this rotting apple, and females, to utilize this resource, have to encounter the males patrolling it, and the males interact with the females. They continually harass them. That interferes with their feeding. But if females choose, they can fly away from the resource, like this bush I've shown nearby, and effectively hide from the males. Because the males patrol the resource, they have a spatial refuge from persistent male courtship. And in a laboratory vial, that's absent altogether. So some people have said because there isn't a spatial refuge, you're seeing far more conflict in the laboratory compared to nature. And that will be true if females truly use the available resource in nature. So a postdoc in my lab, Phil Byrne, did a set of experiments we call semipermeable membrane experiments. He took the adult competition vials and bisected them with a screen. He then reared males under relatively high nutrition conditions. They're only about 2% larger than average, but they are consistently large. And he then adjusted the screen size so they can't get through it. They're stuck on the side where he places them. Females he reared on lower nutritional food. They're well within the normal density, size range, but near the small size. After they yolk up, they can move through the membrane. We then put the live yeast where the males are, just like it is in nature. But females, like nature, have a spatial refuge. They can go through the membrane and get away from the males, but at a price. Just like in nature, to get away from the boys, you give up the high-quality resource. So we had two experiments, a low-resource refuge, like I just described, and a wide-mesh control, where the mesh size was increased so that both sexes freely move between both sizes. This simulates more natural conditions, this standard laboratory protocol. One of the main ways that males hurt females is by remating them, mating them again and again and again. So we looked at remating rate as a surrogate for harm to females. In the no refuge control, like standard laboratory conditions, about 49% of the females remated one or more times. In the low resource refuge, about 40% did. So there's about a 20% reduction in remating in the laboratory, where there is no refuge, compared to the wild conditions where there would be a refuge. So we think that there is higher conflict in our microcosm, but it's a qualitative it's a quantitative difference rather than a qualitative difference.
How about in general, did you say that having a fly in your microcosm, in your vial, that a bull might stress to some extent? They're not happy because there's somehow the meaning of a natural environment.
That's reasonable. But because we've allowed them to adapt to this environment for so many generations, we think that that would be a big concern early on, but not after hundreds of generations of adaptation to this environment.
How many flies do you have?
Oh, everything is done mimicking the conditions we always have, which is 16 pairs.
Just 16 pairs?
Yes. It's difficult to trace. Oh no, we use genetic markers. We use genetic markers to see if they remate. We use genetic markers where we swap out the males. I haven't gone through those details here, but by swapping out the males with different markers, we can see if they remated by the eye color of their progeny. Now, I'll show you in a little bit that we have a back cross population, a population with the same genetic background, but we've introgressed or recombined in a genetic marker. We use that genetic marker to see if they've remated at least once. Some experiments, we actually do watch them remate. I'll show you one of those in a moment. But in this experiment, we use genetic markers to assay remating. Well, in the experiment I just showed you, there are some complications. We had to phenocopy the females to very small size. That might make it unnatural. They're within the normal range of body size, but they were small. And we also didn't measure lifetime fitness. That's the ultimate currency of natural selection, not just some component of fitness. So this summer, with my son, who works in my lab in the summers, we did a different experiment to test the same idea. In red, I've shown the standard laboratory vial, the adult competition vial. And on the right, we've attached this gadget, which gives them space to get away from the food. And in the laboratory, just like in nature, males patrol around the food resource. Because it has an angle on it, females can get away where the males can't even see them anymore. So we tried to give a spatial refuge that did not require phenocopying, that is, making the females an unusual size. Well, did they use the refuge? When they're first put into these vials from the juvenile competition vials, which have spent food, they're hungry. Nobody uses the refuge for the first 4 hours. Later in the day, once they've gotten to eat, there's only about 5% that use it, even when it's available, and on day two, about 19%. But the sex ratio is very different. On day one, there's almost a sevenfold excess of females compared to males using the refuge, and about a twofold excess on day two. So this refuge allowed females to experience a substantially reduced operational sex ratio, fewer males to harass them, and gives them many of the benefits we think they would have gotten in nature. But they still pay the price. To use the refuge, they got to give up the food. We measured the lifetime fecundity of the females. They are identical. And that indicates when females get the advantage of using the refuge, they get a compensating price of lower fecundity. So we see no gain to females of having a spatial refuge when we provide one. And collectively, these two experiments suggest to us that, yes, harm is higher in the microcosm compared to nature, but it nonetheless represents a feasible model system to study male-female coevolution. The next experiment I'm going to tell you about was meant to measure, well, how are the males harming females? And there were some past studies that showed that males harm females by reducing their survival, but that cost is only manifest under very long-lived conditions, far longer than our laboratory protocol permits. And there were problems with how much food they provided, and the results were inconsistent across levels of food. So we had to show in our microcosm that males really are harmful, and we thought one of the currencies, because of the harmful effects of seminal fluid proteins, would be remate rate. This work was done by Bram Kuyper, a graduate student visiting my lab from the Netherlands, and Andrew Stewart, a postdoc in my lab. We measured remating during the time when it occurs, the end of the juvenile competition phase and throughout the adult competition phase. And we put females at their normal density of 16 per vial, starting on day 10. This would be the end of the juvenile competition phase when the females are old enough, mature enough to start mating. But instead of having continuous exposure to 16 males, we gave them brief 2-hour exposure per 24 hours to a 50% excess of males. This gives females plenty of males to choose from. The males don't have enough time to wear down the females and get them to remate when they don't want to. And we're going to look at their remating rate. We then did this 2-hour exposure every day for the period of time when they would normally be able to remate. And we used two types of males. XO males, that means no Y chromosome. The Y is genes that are needed to produce mature sperm. So these are spermless males, but they have normal levels of seminal fluid and seminal fluid proteins. And if a female mates with one of these males, she has a physiological mechanism that allows her to determine she didn't store sperm. When female mates once, she stores enough sperm in specialized sperm storage organs to last for her entire lifetime in this microcosm. But if she detects she didn't store sperm, she's keen to mate again to get some. We also used intact XY males. They have normal seminal fluid and transfer sperm when they mate as well. In the first treatment, we mated females for the first 2 days to intact males. They get the sperm they need. They're not keen to mate thereafter. With only a 2-hour exposure to males thereafter, they don't remate again. So females on average mate just one time. Now we can move back the exposure of intact males. They get spermless males here. By day 11, they say, whoa, we didn't get sperm, so they're keen to mate again. They do. By here, there's almost no remating, and they virtually never mate thereafter. So now we've got them to mate twice. And we can move back the exposure to intact males further and further back and experimentally control how many times they remate. It took me 6 years to figure out how to do this experiment. We tried all kinds of things to get females to be able to say, you remate and you don't, and it's extremely hard to do. But by using these two types of males, it became easy. This is just a graph of the number of rematings, and we watched these flies and recorded matings. So this wasn't done indirectly, but directly. This just shows that our treatments did modify the remate level, the number of matings that females had. And this is a plot on a semi-log basis of number of matings per female versus the lifetime fecundity of the females. And what you see is that there's a curvilinear relationship and a negative one with a number of matings. So the more times a female remates, and these are averages per vial of 16, that's what's plotted on the x-axis, the lower their fecundity. The curvilinearity indicates that the more they remate, proportionately, the more it harms them. If the proportionate harm were constant, we'd see a straight line relationship. The curvilinear relationship indicates that every time female mates again, it hurts her more than the previous mating. So we think that this data indicates that in our short-lived population, there truly is a cost to males remating females. The more they remate, the lower their fecundity. If they remate four times, they nearly halve their fecundity. So the next two experiments I want to tell you about were meant to quantify the costs and the benefits of all interactions with males, not just remating. There's a lot of behavioral interactions where males harry females. When they run away from them, they can't feed. So there's a large component of harm that's just due to interacting with males. So we focused on the adult competition phase when there's persistent courtship of females by males. And we're going to use what I call a spreadsheet approach to measure what they cost, what do they lose by interacting in males, and what do they get back in return, potentially genetic benefits. So I want to go through the kind of female phenotype we're trying to understand. We're trying to understand what would happen to a female if she expressed a new mutation that gave her resistance to male-induced harm. So we're focusing on this part of the life history, and during this time, males are persistently courting females, trying to remate with them, and frequently succeeding. Now I want you to consider a mutant in females that, once she's mated, but not before, causes her to express a male pheromone. Because she expresses the male pheromone after she's no longer virgin, she gets to mate, but once she's mated, when a male encounters her, he senses that she's a male rather than a female, so he leaves her alone. So females benefit from the mutation because persistent male courtship and harassment and remating go away, but now they don't have the ability to trade up to higher quality genetic males, and they're stuck with the first male they happen to mate with. So there's a protection that this mutation provides, persistent male courtship and remating, but there's a harm. She can't trade up to higher quality offspring. So I want to quantify the cost of such a mutation next. In a few minutes, I'm going to experimentally create that mutation and trace its fate through time. Now we're going to try and predict what should happen to it. So these experiments were done by Jody Linder in my laboratory. She collected virgins at the normal time, when they're virgins early on in the juvenile competition phase of their life cycle. And then she mated females at the beginning of the adult competition phase by giving them brief exposure, 90 minutes, to a threefold excess of males. This gets virtually every female mated in a very short exposure to males. Then she randomly assigns them to a male-protected environment, an adult competition vial without males, and the normal 1-to-1 sex ratio. To look at the consequences of interacting with males, she measured their lifetime fecundity, the appropriate time, the last 18 hours of their 2-week generation cycle. So I can summarize these experiments by plotting lifetime fecundity of females versus the male exposure treatment. And she found a 16% reduction in lifetime fecundity due to remating and due to interactions with males when they're present compared to when they're not. So this indicates, one experiment, that there's a harm from interacting with males, and the magnitude's about 16%. It's just one experiment, though. But we've measured the variation among replicates on female fecundity between vials within a replicate and between females within vials. From this variation measurement, we can calculate a 95% lower bound of 10%. So 16% is just one estimate, but we could also say that it's at least 10%. I've now had people in my lab repeat this experiment 24 times, and we now know that the average is actually 21%, with a 95% lower bound of 19%. So about 20% of a female's lifetime fecundity is lost due to the cost of interacting with males. Well, what about the benefits? One potential benefit are material benefits. And we know in some Drosophila species, males transfer seminal fluid proteins and females digest them and use the products of those proteins to invest in more offspring. It's called seminal feeding. But in Melanogaster, that does not happen. There's no other type of nuptial feeding, so we know that there are no material benefits that females get from interacting with males. There could be good viability genes. And we've tested this twice on this slide, once and we're about to publish now, it's a third time, and it's been tested for in our population by an independent laboratory, and everyone showed no net viability benefit. So we think we can rule out this possibility. But sexy sons we cannot rule out. We know from genetic screens we've done over the last 10 years that there's abundant variation, genetic variation, for the prowess that males have in the context of sexual selection. Some are hot shots and some are not. So Nicole Ortiza looked at remated females using genetic markers. She classified the offspring as those derived from the primary sire, the first male that she mated with, and then a second or higher level male that she mated with. And if when she mates another time, she's trading up to get good sexy son genes for her offspring, then we should see higher grand offspring per son when it comes from a remated, when it comes from a secondary male compared to a primary male. Well, we're testing to see if they do get an advantage. So if females are, we know they're being hurt by interacting with males in the adult competition phase. We also know that 99% of them have already mated at the juvenile competition phase at the end and don't need to remate. So they're being harmed, now they get something from it. One way they could get something is to trade up by remating with higher quality males. So yeah, it hurts to interact with those males, but if they remate and trade up to better genes for their offspring, that could compensate. Well, yeah, that's the idea. If they don't, then they can't gain this way. But if they do, and it's hard to see the world from a fly's perspective. So we just know that it's a possibility that we can test for. So I'm not saying it happens, but what we're doing is testing to see if we have evidence that it happens. Yeah. Yes, because they give them more grandchildren. So the quality is they're better in the context of sexual selection. Not in terms of viability, but in terms of sexual selection. So I can summarize the results of these experiments by plotting the number of grand offspring produced through either primary sires or secondary or higher level sires. We call them secondary sires because we can't tell if she remated twice or three times or four times. And Nicole didn't find a difference. Doesn't mean there isn't one. It means we didn't find one. But again, we've measured the genetic variation among replicates, among vials within replicates, and among females within vials. So we can calculate a 95% upper bound of any benefit that was there that we missed. And that upper bound is 6%. Now, this is only manifest through sons. Sexy sons, by definition, only occurs through sons. So to put it in the same currency as harm, we get the benefit in daughters, which is 0, plus the benefit in sons, which is 6%, for an average across the sexes of 3%. Yeah?
Would it be simpler to simply introduce this mutation among part of the population, the mutation which only allows the single mating?
Mm-hmm.
And then just watch the mutation grows?
Well, that's exactly what I'm going to do. So first I wanted to predict what would happen in the experiment, and then I'm going to do the experiment. So we want to say, well, what are the costs and benefits? That allows us to predict what the selection coefficient on such a mutation would be. Then we'll create it, flux it into a population, and trace its fate. So these are the costs and benefits. A 95% lower bound on the cost, a 95% upper bound on the benefits. So overall, we have good evidence that indirect benefits don't compensate the direct costs. But as you pointed out, we can do better. And in the next experiment, we use experimental evolution to create the female resistance allele and trace its fate through time. So we're going to take a female resistance gene, put it into the gene pool, and then watch its fate. If costs really outweigh benefits, the resistance gene will accumulate. If benefits outweigh costs, natural selection will purge it from the gene pool. So we can use this kind of experiment to check our calculations. This work was done by Andrew Stewart and Ted Morrow, two postdocs in my lab. As I indicated earlier, we've made a brown replica of our base population by introgressing, by recombining a single marker into the population, so the genetic background is nearly identical except for the presence or absence of this marker. So we can now take a red-eyed individual from one population, put it into the other, and that simulates a new mutation occurring in that population. When we introduce new individuals, the gene can be in a homozygous state, two copies, or a single state, It's a dominant gene, so one or two copies give you the same phenotype, red eyes. And if you don't have the gene, you have brown eyes, which is a recessive marker. Now, to use experimental evolution to make an arbitrary marker into a female resistance gene, if the female has red eyes, we put her into a male protected environment. If she has brown eyes, she goes into a male unprotected environment. So by using experimental evolution, we can make any arbitrary marker into a female resistance gene and then trace its fate. So this gene is going to have costs and benefits. The females benefit by not interacting with males, and therefore male harm from remating and harassment goes away, but now she can't trade up. So I can summarize these results by looking at the resistance allele frequency versus generation time. All the populations started at a frequency of 7.5%. You might say, well, why not start with one copy? Well, you can, but almost every experiment is the same. You lose it by chance. So when you only have one copy of the allele in the gene pool, you almost always lose it by sampling error. If you start with low but higher frequency, then deterministic processes predominate, and we can actually look at selection on the allele itself, not sampling error. We had five control populations, and here we introduced the marker allele, but we didn't convert it into a resistance allele. That is, all females went into a one-to-one sex ratio adult competition vial, irrespective of the presence or absence of the red allele. This allows us to measure pleiotropic, that is, other selection on the allele, because that's going to influence its fate through time. And as you can see, it increased in all the populations. But in the experimental populations, it increased much more rapidly when it was also a female resistance allele. We can now subtract out from the controls the increase in frequency attributable to pleiotropic natural selection and just look at the female resistance selection. That's plotted right here. From this plot, we can calculate the mean selection coefficient on the allele. It's about 20%. Our cost-benefit analysis predicted it would be 22%, and the close correspondence suggests to us we've done a pretty good job of measuring costs and benefits of female resistance. So far, I've tried to show you evidence that the melanogaster model system is a reasonable one to study sexual conflict, that it harms females to mate with males. The more they mate, the more they're harmed, and that there truly is conflict in this microcosm that isn't compensated by indirect genetic benefits. Now I want to show you the evidence we have for an ongoing arms race between male sexual selection and female resistance in our base population. And I'm going to use a technique we call hemiclonal analysis, and it has four stages. The first is create a laboratory island population, which I've already described. The second is to use genome-wide cytogenetic cloning, which allows us to clone an entire set of genes simultaneously. This turns out to be remarkably simple. Then estimate the additive genetic variation among these hemiclones, among full sets of genes, and then estimate the selection on that variation. So first, how do we do genome-wide cytogenetic cloning? If I go through the cytogenetic details, people sleep. So I'm not going to go through the details, but I've got them at the end of the seminar if anybody wants to see them. And nobody's asked, but I'll be happy to go through them. They're there. But I am going to show you the logic of the technique. And it starts with this schematic of my dad. Here he is. The red Y represents the non-recombining portion, most of his Y chromosome, and the dash is all the rest of his genes. Similarly, schematically displayed, here's me and my two brothers. And now my son and his four male cousins from my two brothers. Over two generations, my father's Y chromosome has been clonally amplified, all the genes on it simultaneously, fivefold. Because it doesn't recombine with the X, they're transmitted as one big linkage unit, intact across generations. What I'm going to do with melanogaster is use cytogenetic tricks to make the whole genome, one haploid or set of genes from one parent or the other, co-segregate like a giant non-recombining Y chromosome, and by doing it, I can clonally amplify a full set of genes, just like my dad's Y chromosome was amplified. So we start with a randomly drawn fly from the base population. It's a male. It's got two sets of genes. The red one is arbitrarily the half that we're going to capture. We mate him to a specially constructed clone generator female. She has a compound X. We've attached both X chromosomes to a common centromere, so they segregate like one unit. We put a Y chromosome in her from the base population that doesn't masculinize her. And then we translocate or scramble the two major autosomes so they co-segregate among the living offspring as if they were one. And when we make this mating to this funny female, we get a male, and we only take one, that's got one full set of genes from his dad, and his dad was randomly drawn from the population, so this is a random genome-wide set of genes, and a funny set of genes from his mom. We then cross this one son to many more clone generator females, and we produce lots of sons. I've only shown three here, but there's lots of them. They all have intact one set of genes from their dad and a funny set from their mom, and the construction of the clone generator female causes all the genes G to co-segregate like one giant chromosome. Male Drosophila melanogaster, for reasons that aren't known, don't have molecular crossing over. So chromosomes remain intact, and the only way they recombine is by assortment of different chromosomes, one from mom, one from dad. With the genetic markers we have in here, we can identify any mixtures and throw them away and just keep the ones that get the full set. So now to get rid of the funny genes, we cross them to wild-type females, and we get a hemiclone. This hemiclone has one full set of genes, genome-wide in common, and the rest of genetic background is randomly drawn. By analogy, this is the same as taking one sperm, clonally amplifying it to hundreds of copies, randomly taking a group of eggs from the population and fertilizing with the one clone sperm. The entity that we produce is a hemiclone. They share in common one genome-wide set of genes, each expressed in a random genetic background. So there's no inbreeding problems here because they're all expressed in a random genetic background. Once you develop this technique, you can go to the base population, make a bucket full of these things, and then you can look at the phenotypic variation. Phenotypic variation is the variation that you can see among the hemiclones. And we can use genetic analysis of variance to ask how much of this phenotypic variation is additive genetic variation. How much of the variation is caused by genetic variation that can be transmitted to offspring. Next, we have to look at the fitness variation among the hemiclones. We do this in a fairly simple way. We put in 25 hemiclonal eggs into a standard vial, and then 125 competitors that are genetically marked with the Brown recessive mutation. We run them through their normal culturing protocol and measure how many offspring are produced from the original 25 eggs. In this way, we measure all fitness components through the entire life history, and we have a measure of net fitness, looking at all components of fitness simultaneously. So that allows us to get a selection gradient. This is the fitness variation among hemiclones, how much of it's genetic, and what are the selective consequences of that variation. If this, for example, were sperm competitive ability, high and low, high competitive ability has high fitness, low competitive ability has low fitness. If this were body size, then high body size would have high fitness, low body size, low fitness. So we can measure how much of the phenotypic variation is genetic variation, and what are the consequences of that variation on natural selection. So now I'm going to put this to work. We took a sample of 35 random hemiclones from the base population, and Jody Linder and Tim Liu expressed these in females, and using the technique I showed you before, they measured female resistance by putting females in protected and unprotected environments from the same hemiclone. And in every case, female fitness goes down when boys are present. But this interaction plot shows that, yes, all the curves go down in the unprotected environment where males are present compared to the protected. They go down to different degrees. Some hemiclones are more affected by the presence of males than others. The difference in these slopes represents the difference in resistance that females have to male-induced harm. I can express that as a histogram, so that's the phenotypic variation. And when we use genetic analysis of variance, we can say how much of that phenotypic or variation we can see is actually heritable variation that can be transmitted to offspring. It is a low proportion, but statistically significant. And that's what you expect for traits that are under strong directional natural selection. We next asked why. What is it that makes some hemiclones more resistant than others? And the obvious candidate was remate rate. Females that remate more, we showed earlier, have lower fitness. So we screened the 35 hemiclones for remate rate, and we found remarkable variation. Some hemiclones are eventually monogamous. They mate once, and only about 5% ever mate again. Others are highly promiscuous, where over 90% of the individuals will remate at least one time. So lots of variation for remate rate among hemiclones. We found that part of that variation was due to additive genetic variation in the population, and the selection gradient is negative. Those hemiclones that remate more have lower lifetime fecundity than those that remate at higher level. Urban Freiberg, a graduate student visiting my lab from Sweden, took the same 35 hemiclones and expressed them now in males. He then put males into adult competition vials with previously mated females and asked how good are they at persuading the girls to remate with them. So the better they are, the higher their what's called offense ability. He found significant phenotypic variation among the hemiclones. Some are very good at remating females. Some are very poor at it. He found low but significant additive genetic variation. So some of this variation has a genetic basis. And the selection gradient was positive. Those hemiclones that were better at remating had higher lifetime fitness than those that were lower. So we have variation in females for remate rate and in males. These experiments were done one in 1 year, one in the next year. We get variation from month to month in remate rate, so that's why these don't line up in the same spot. But we have genetic variation for both traits. We can now look at the correlation of the same set of genes, the same hemiclone. This is a bivariate plot of remate rate when expressed in a male of one hemiclone and then expressed in females. And we find no evidence for a positive correlation. That means that different genes cause variation in remate rate in males compared to females. The fact that we get opposite selection gradients on different variation that affect the shared trait, remate rate, suggests to us that we've captured the arms race in progress. There's variation for remate rate in males, and they're moving toward remating more. There's genetic variation for remating in females. They're moving toward remating less. These are largely canceling, so you don't see much change through time, despite the fact that each sex is actively evolving in the population. So a common criticism of the kind of work that I do in microcosm by many of my colleagues is, hey, it's just flies in bottles. And early on, I told you that evolutionary biologists have learned a lot about evolution by studying island populations because they're simpler. When Darwin studied tortoises on the Galapagos Islands, he wasn't trying to make inference to mainland populations in South America. He was interested in the islands in and of themselves. By making comparisons between islands, he developed general principles that he could apply to mainland South America and anywhere else in the world. The microcosm that I study is extremely small and extremely simple, but it's that simplicity that makes it so useful. I can do things in the lab that my field biologist colleagues can only dream about. I can measure the total fitness gradient on traits. I have all the power of Drosophila genetics at my disposal. And if I see a pattern, I can set up microevolutionary experiments like the female resistance gene experiment to see if the patterns I see are for the reasons I think they're there. So I think that even though it is flies in bottles, I think we can derive evolutionary principles from them by studying microcosms. So to sum everything up, early on in the talk, I tried to persuade you that the laboratory model system is a reasonable one for studying conflict, even if there isn't a spatial refuge. Males really do harm females, and there's active selection for female resistance. And then in the second part of the talk, I tried to show you that there's evidence for ongoing antagonistic coevolution in our base population by using this hemiclonal analysis technique. Okay, I want to thank the people to pay the bills, and I'll take questions. Yeah. saying one advantage of sex is that it allows you to track environmental change. As your pathogens change, you can change accordingly. Is that what you're saying?
I simply was told by biologists that there is an advantage of sexual over asexual.
It's one of many, but it's one. Yes?
So, in your case, your population is not challenged by environment in that particular.
Oh, there are. There's lots of pathogens in our environment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you could argue perhaps that if you name, you might have a larger variability, which would benefit the whole population and being exposed to disease.
Yes.
In nature, but not in your arrival because they are not charged.
Okay, the idea that things evolve because they're good for the species was very common up until the 1920s or so. And it's still found in introductory biology books today that things evolve for the good of the species. It turns out that that's almost never the case. Things evolve because they're good for the individual. And we can do mathematical models of challenging a population with two things going on: evolution for the good of the group, evolution for good for the individual. Because the rate of evolution is so much faster in terms of the individual, it swamps anything that protects for the population as a whole. So traits we see that are good for the population evolve because they're good for the individual. Nonetheless, you're right that my environment doesn't have an advantage to sex that might be applied in natural populations because the environment doesn't change as quickly. One thing that makes the environment change are pathogens, but there's other things. There's weather and other things as well. And that's just part of this microcosm. That's part of the reality that we give up. It's not quite as simple as you think. There are lots of nasty things that live in the food, and the flies have to contend them. We can sterilize the food, but as soon as you put the flies in, all kinds of stuff starts growing. Bacteria, mold, and the flies have to contend with those. Those change with the time of year. They change with the vagaries of what comes in when you open the door. So we do have plenty of pathogens for our flies in there. But it's not. We don't have the kind of variability that occurs in nature. It's less. But it's true on islands. Islands have less variation than mainland populations, yet they've played a big role in understanding evolutionary principles because of the simplicity.
So if you follow this mutant population, mm-hmm. one which the females will make just one, do you see a reduction in genetic variety of the population?
No, in fact, it goes the other way. If you have monogamy, if you mate once, you tend to maintain more genetic variation than when you mate multiple times. And the reason for that is what's called the effective population size is influenced by promiscuous mating. The more promiscuous the mating is, there are some males that are very good at sexual selection, some are relatively poor. Their contribution to the next generation is higher, and standing variance actually goes down when you have promiscuity compared to monogamy.
Mm-hmm. Change the volume of confinement.
Yes. I can't tell you for sure, but we have evolutionary models of how evolution proceeds when the effective population size, the number of breeding adults, varies. And when the numbers are small, say 10 or 20 or 30, you get a lot of artifacts. You get a lot more expression of inbreeding depression, and you get a lot more sampling error influencing natural influencing changes in gene frequency as opposed to natural selection. Once you rise around by around 500, mutational input of new variation compared to the loss due to natural selection is largely compensating. We're at a value that's about four times that value. The effective size is about 1,800 in our population. So we don't think that making our population twice as big or half as big would make much difference.
I mean, the density of population, that's important.
Oh.
You make the density of population much more dense.
Yeah, it turns out it doesn't. We've tried increasing the density of males, and the males are persuading females to remate with them.
No, if you change the density, I mean, if you increase those simultaneously, density of males and females,
yeah.
Nothing has changed but the size of the space where the disease is spread.
Yeah, I was trying to respond to that. When the density becomes higher, the males have an elaborate courtship display that they use. As density gets higher, one male interferes with the other one, giving his courtship display with females, and they're less successful. So you would think with higher density, you'd get higher remating. But it doesn't really work that way, because the male traits they use to persuade females to remate with them, females are bigger and aggressively dominant to males. They have to choose to remate. Males can harry them and wear them down, but ultimately the female has to say yes. If a male mounts her and tries to copulate, she can evert her ovipositor and say no. So females have to be convinced to mate with males. And the ability to convince a female to mate with a male goes down as density gets too high. Just because the males can't use their tricks, their courtship song and their courtship dance is less effective when other males interfere. No, I can't. I know that there can be vagaries in what mutations are introduced through time. 5 years ago, if you said, what proportion of females remate in the adult competition phase, I'd say it's always about two-thirds. Now it's 99%. Something has happened. We think that males have a new adaptation that allows me better persuading females. 5 years from now, I wouldn't be surprised if it goes down to 50%, where females evolve a new resistance allele. So I can't predict those because they're so rare, we don't know which ones are going to come in when. Oh, I expect it will be oscillatory. That's right, where the selection on males goes up when females are more resistant, and selection on females goes down when they are more resistant. Did I follow the evolution system in the beginning?
No.
One that I just described is the remate rate. We don't monitor that much about it because it's a lot of work just to set it up. Sounds silly, I suppose.
But the time setting it up, which is about 50 years ago, follow what changes in the population and created your...
No, but many other labs have. So the rate of adaptation to laboratories is remarkably fast. Most of it occurs in the first 10 generations or so. So it's very rapid adaptation to the laboratory environment for about 10 to 20 generations, and it slows down thereafter. So you can take flies that have been in the lab for 5 generations and compete them those that they're just brought in from nature, 10 generations, 20, and they reach a plateau by around 20 generations. It still goes up, but nowhere near as quickly. But you asked, have we taken many characters and watched them through time? The answer is no. I built it to be a population I could easily measure fitness on, and the trait that we've explored is sexual conflict over that time. But I haven't been exploring other traits as well, just because there's only so much time to go around.